I think not only are we in the place where the German people were in September of 1939 in terms of our responsibility and the threat of the rise of global fascism, because Mussolini called fascism corporatism plus reaction. He said it was when the state and the corporations merged into one. And that is objectively what fascism is. Fascism is not Adolf Hitler, an anti-Semite that decides to get a whole country to go along with killing all the Jews and tries to take over the world. It is an objective economic and political reality that develops from the final stages of monopoly capitalism. When wealth concentrates to a particular level, and when technology moves forward at a particular level, human labor becomes expendable. The first people killed in the Holocaust were the mental patients because they were useless eaters. They were taking up space. They were Untermenschen. The American Psychiatric Association, the World Psychiatric Association, the World Eugenics Associations were like this. They believed that they could clean the gene pool out. In fact, the defense at Nuremberg was, why are you taking us to court for this? You started mass sterilization in 1928 in the United States. You started getting rid of these people that didn't fit in the gene pool and the feeble-minded. You taught us how to put people into concentration camps with what you did to the Native Americans. And we're just doing what you did, so why are you taking us to court? I mean, one genocide doesn't justify the next, but it's a legitimate question that we seem unable to ask. I mean, we blame the rest of the world for what basically we've done and the situations that we've set up. And these things are being done in our name. I mean, after 9/11, all these people said, well, why do they hate us? You know, and I was like, well, if you don't know history, and many people don't because they don't teach it in school, you don't know what's being done in your name abroad for the last 50 years. But the people in those countries know. They know the corporations that came in. They know who came in and stole their labor. They know who put the dictator in that repressed them. They know where the money was coming from. They see what the relations are to the U.S. military and the U.S. State Department and the embassy there. They're not fooled. But the American people have to be kept in the dark about it because it's being done in their name. And so we feel that we're benign. You know, don't we give a lot of foreign aid to people abroad? Yes. 70% of it happens to be weapons. We're the good guys, and the rest of the world is evil, and we don't understand why anybody would hate us. And then they came out and told us that bin Laden is attacking us because we're a large, pluralist, democratic, rich country. And they just can't stand that. And I said, well, why aren't they bombing Canada, too? Could it be something to do with Canada's foreign policy, maybe? I mean, it's not to justify the deaths. It's a crime against humanity, what happened on September 11th. But it's a crime, not an act of war. It should have been dealt with, as Nuremberg was, in an international tribunal. The Taliban said three times they would turn bin Laden over to an international tribunal, and Bush said, we don't negotiate with terrorists. But that was the proper response, not the wars that they wanted to go into and all of that phoniness. But they've got us so afraid of each other and afraid of everybody else around the world, and that's, I mean, it's a classic protection racket. You know what a protection racket is for the mob? You know, the window in your store gets broken and Louis comes by. Good, sorry about the window. $100 a month or so would probably make sure that don't happen again. But you don't want to pay it. You know, something worse could happen. A place could burn down or something. You know. That's a protection racket. I mean, I'm supposed to be more afraid of bin Laden in his cave, you know, Dr. Nosama, where's James Bond, than I am of the system, you know, that created the cave and that created the threat and that armed the threat and, you know, that as far as I can tell manipulates the threat, maybe as a negative asset, maybe as a positive asset. I don't know, but I mean, I'm afraid of the people that are taking my life and my democracy and the lives of people all around the world away. It's like Malcolm X said, if you read the newspapers long enough, you'll end up loving the people doing the oppressing and hating the people being oppressed. And you've got to figure out what that is. But the other thing you have to figure out, I think, is what fascism is, because that corporatization is now not just a couple of, it's not Tyson Steele and IG Farben, it's international global corporations. It's Hitler gone global, gone mad. I mean, he might have wanted to take over the world, but the corporations that were financing him weren't already the world and didn't own so much of it. And so, you know, it's a global lineup of these countries at the top, the United States and, you know, the European Union and the new wannabes. China joins the World Trade Organization September 12th. First call to Bush is from Putin and Russia, you know, and they want to line up. And then the rest is the pockets of resistance within the neoliberal countries and the underdeveloped masses. Those are expendable, and then us. I mean, the people here that are going to resist. Okay. And overall, when you don't need the labor anymore, I mean, they don't need the labor in Iraq to run those oil wells. So that population is expendable to them. And then based on where your racial views are, based on whatever, you know, your genetic views, whatever, you're going to pick those segments in the society that can go first, or that you're not going to worry about. Maybe you'll speed it up a little. Reinhard Gehling suggested that the concentration camps, he was Hitler's head of intelligence, in his memoirs at the end of the war were too messy and that they ought to figure out how to create natural disasters that wipe out hundreds of thousands of people at a time. But the objective pressure of that concentration of wealth, if you're not going to make that surplus, and that's what it is, objectively the world is in surplus. Objectively, there is enough arable land, there is enough resources, there is enough technology for every single person on Earth to be clothed and housed and fed, to have medical care, to have transportation, to have communication, to be interneted even, to be entertained, without the destructiveness to the rest of the planet, without wiping all the rest of the species, without destroying the ozone layers and all of that. There are ways that would work. But it takes a decentralized model to make them work. It takes a community model to make them work. But they're there. Objectively, they're there. And if all you do with that surplus is control it and consolidate it into the hands of a few, then the rest of us are the Untermenschen. That's just the there's an objective pressure for genocide because you don't need those people and they potentially represent a threat to you. And then certainly along the racial lines where you dehumanize whole segments of the population. So that's sort of the nightmare path, and of course it also takes a permanent war economy and permanent war and civil dissent, you know, end of the Constitution, martial law and all those things. That's the nightmare path, but we're at that crossroads now. We don't have a lot of time. We don't have all the wiggle room we could. We've got more wiggle room than anyone else on Earth to not go down that path, to change that path in the other direction toward a world that's different. But in order to build that world, you have to have the imagination to understand not only what your enemy is and what form it takes, but of this global fascism and these international relations and the economic relation that capitalism forces all of us into with each other and how that could be broken. You know, how you pull back aspects of human community that have been stolen from you and then sold back to you in their most distorted form by this system. But you also have to have the imagination to see what a real democracy would look like. And I would submit to you that the democracy envisioned by Thomas Jefferson was not adequate in his mind for the following generation. And he said it himself. He said there will probably have to be a revolution in this country every 20 years to make sure that power doesn't aggregate again in the hands of the few. He said he wouldn't expect his children to wear a threadbare coat just that he owned just because he liked to wear it. He said if he built a fort around them to protect them from a threat and the threat went away, he wouldn't force them to live in the fort any longer. He said that if he planted a tree so they could have fruit to eat and they didn't like the fruit, he wouldn't force them to eat it. These are his metaphors for he knew that his imagination only stretched so far and that then every subsequent generation would have to imagine and realize its own freedom, its own sense of democracy. The other thing Jefferson realized in Washington as well is that parties, political parties, are inimical to democracy. Jefferson said that in any given society, you can only have two parties no matter what they call themselves. Those who want to take power from the people and put it in the hands of the few, he called the aristocrats. Those who want to do the reverse and put power in the hands of the people, he called the democrats. But he said if you build a democratic government machinery and you build a constitution that's actually democratic and a social contract that's democratic, you don't need a democratic party. And Washington, when he left office, said that policies belong to the people as a whole, and that parties put those decisions back in the hands of a few. When you lived in the 1700s, your only method of communication and travel was either a horse or a boat. When the meeting you had to go to was going to be 2 days away by horse, the whole community couldn't go, so you picked a representative to go. Smaller community, maybe not too far fallen from the tree, probably picked the guy you wanted around the least and sent him off for 2 weeks to listen and be your representative and then bring back the report. We're in the 21st century. We don't rely on a horse and a boat. We have mass communication. It's a commonwealth. You'll say the corporations own the media. They don't own the media. They monopolize the licenses. But the licenses are issued on the basis of it being a commonwealth, and they're issued by the public to the broadcasters. They own some of the broadcasting equipment. That hardly seems insurmountable. But it is still a commonwealth that belongs to all of us, and it's our public media. So we should take back sufficient time to raise issues with each other and debate them in an open way, and then everyone participate in the decision-making power that we should have, because that's a power that belongs to all of us. And we know by now, don't we, that any representative that we would put in our stead can be blackmailed or bullied or bulleted or bribed. It's not so hard to control 400 or 500 people. It's a little harder when the decisions rest in the hands of us all. And it can be done in a fair way. It can be done in an open way. You also have to break open the commonwealth of the educational system here so that people get real information. See, government, Jefferson said, given a choice between a government without a newspaper and a newspaper without a government, he would always choose the latter, because he understood that the flow of information is more central to democratic process than the machinery you set up to carry it out. But that's all that is machinery that you set up to carry out your vision of democracy. And if it ain't working, then you dismantle it and you put some machinery together that makes it happen in the right way. And, I mean, I don't vote for representatives. I have two buttons. One says if voting worked, it would be illegal. And the other says don't vote, it only encourages them. Okay. I would gladly vote for a referendum, but not the kind of referendum they have out and in issues they have in many of the places out here, because those are rigged so that only the rich can get enough signatures to get over the hump. But if you made it voting registration automatic, if you made it very simple to put something on the ballot and then maybe chose what were the most popular ones for each month and ran them, then you could debate them and you could choose by them. But there's no reason not to be making those decisions, especially when they affect lots of people, and not to be making them on a decentralized level. Not all on some kind of a national or state level, but a decentralized level that thinks globally and acts locally, but also does the reverse, that when it acts globally, it thinks locally. And you can put those two things together and build. And then if you're going to pay taxes, and I would say, there is alternative of alternate money and not having a money or a tax system and all that, but if you're going to pay taxes, we have a bumper sticker in D.C. that says taxation without representation, because we don't even have a voting representative. We have Eleanor Holmes Norton who can go and sit on a committee, but you can't vote. Now, my version of representation with taxes is not Eleanor Holmes Norton voting for me, because she doesn't represent me. I doubt I could represent anyone else in the room here, much less all of you. Why would I want to try? I can represent myself perfectly well, as can you. And if your response to this is, yeah, but people are too stupid, Jefferson thought of that too. He said, the only safe repository for power is in the hands of the people. He said, if you think them unable to exercise their discretion in a wholesome fashion, that means you think they're idiots. Okay. He said, the solution is not to take the power from them and put it in the hands of an elite. The solution is to inform their discretion. That you have to trust rationality, you have to trust communication, and the ability that we can educate each other and ourselves about things. Does it mean we'd never be wrong? No. But I would tell you, we will fix a mistake sooner than this system will fix a mistake, and we won't vote for things that are obviously not in our own self-interest on a broader scale. You know, will there be differences? Of course there will be, you know. But breaking through some of those other things would make it possible. But if I was going to pay tax to the federal government, I think that I would want the last page of the tax form to be an allocation form. Now, that would be taxation with representation because I would directly allocate the tax that I paid. And I even want to just send a three-part carbon out to everybody that pays taxes in my community and show them a brochure with a pie. Here's where your money's currently being spent. Here's your blank pie. Fill it in. Put it in with your tax form. Doesn't have any legal weight, but tell them how you'd like the money to go. Send one to your representative or put it in the drawer and send one back to me. I'll take the results. I'll put them into a people's tax pie. I'll go to the voting record and put up the representative's tax pie. I can guarantee you they won't be the same pie. And then I'll ask the representative to come out and explain who it is that they're representing. Well, it's very simple, but it plants that seed. You've got Bush running around saying, it's your money, it's your money. And I said, yes, it is my money, and I want to allocate it. I don't want the chump change back that's left for social services after you overfund the Pentagon and the CIA. I want to spend the money myself. Okay? And it's a process. I mean, you know, I'm not saying these are magical solutions, but if you don't start thinking of a different way to invent democracy this late, then we are going to go on the nightmare path. And if you don't understand that your loyalty belongs to the human race and not to a flag, not to a country that's supposedly under attack from some mystical force that's out there that you can't understand. I mean, these terrorists, the way they're presented to us, is as if they dropped in from outer space. All you know about them is that they hate you and they want to kill you. You can't negotiate with them. You can't talk to them. You can't understand them. All you can do is kill them. And you got to kill every last one, except you never know. It's like the pod people, you know, maybe it spread to somebody else and then you got to start killing them, you know, and how long is it you start fingering each other? Well, I think you're one of them, you know. And it's just dead end. I mean, if it's the 21st century, we know what war does. And now the weapons that make it happen are so bad that the planet is not going to survive. If we don't make war obsolete, we're going to make ourselves obsolete. Right? And I don't know, I mean, maybe talking to the choir here. I went to Bemidji, Minnesota recently. I had a great time. I talked to people in the community and people at the school and classes of kids and stuff like that. But these ideas are ideas, I think, that aren't beyond ordinary people. But we've got to be willing to break down, even in ourselves, a tendency to want dogma. I mean, I'm not telling you this stuff so you'll follow me around and say, well, I'm a judgist. You know, I mean, I do these things because I'm hoping that a little bit of humor, a little bit of perspective, it'll open up something for you that you'll look at the paradigm a different way. In fact, I wanted to write a memoir. I've been thinking about a title of a memoir would be Brother, Can You Paradigm? All right? Because if you can't paradigm, you're in trouble. You know, and it's not that everything they're telling you is a lie, but the focus, the lens, they've got it a little skewered so that you don't see it straight when you look at it. So, and I'm in trouble already. You can go on the internet and find out that I'm a government intelligence agent and I'm part of a disinformation campaign because I say that Flight 77 went into the Pentagon. I don't think it's a burning question about 9/11. I think there are much bigger questions, but Flight 77 did go into the Pentagon. There were hundreds of witnesses that saw Flight 77 go into the Pentagon. I've talked to quite a few of them, you know, and you've got all these people not only saying, is it a question, but it's a religion. And if we approach our belief systems as religions, then we're going to put people out in the street, you know, and away from us. But if we approach it as respect between two people, and let's see if we can't get to the truth. You know, I often say in my lectures, because people come at you afterwards and say, gee, you talked about this, and my uncle did that, you know, and a little piece of the woman at the picnic table. If we told the stories of our own families, the whole system would break. They do what they're doing because they are deathly afraid of us. They need for us to be in denial. They need for us to try to protect the little bit of privilege we have over somebody else rather than sharing. They need us to keep the needle in our arm, the television on, the consumer mentality going, keep quiet, consume, and die. And they're afraid of us. And they need us to feel that we are powerless. But we are the least powerless people on the planet. And there might be a way for the whole rest of the world to stand up to this juggernaut, but it wouldn't be easy. But where the potential is to stand up for it is right here among us. And the moral responsibility to stand up to it is right here, because it's being done in our name. And it's being done each day. And we can build another world. We can invent another world. We can include each other. We can build community. We don't have to be afraid of each other, but we have to tell the truth. And once we tell the truth to ourselves and to others, once we pull the needle out of our arm and say, I'm not playing anymore, that's it. Game's over.
That was independent political researcher John Judge, co-founder of 9/11 Citizens Watch, speaking last February in Seattle. Thanks to Mike McCormick for this tape.